The 2016 Florida legislative session starts January 12th. We're previewing some of the bills lawmakers are proposing. This is Florida Matters.
Support for Florida Matters comes from the Hospitals of BayCare Health System, providing more than 100 health seminars, classes, and events each month. BayCare's mission is to build a healthier Tampa Bay. Register for a complimentary health seminar, class, or event at baycareevents.org.
From the Donna Studio at WUSF Public Media, I'm Carson Cooper. On today's show, we're previewing some of the proposals expected to come up during the Florida legislative session, which starts on January 12th. Florida's education commissioner used to be an elected position as a member of the Florida cabinet. That changed in 2002 when a constitutional amendment took effect to allow the governor to appoint the commissioner. Now, two Republican lawmakers are renewing the call to make the education commissioner elected once again. Florida Matters' Bobby O'Brien caught up with former elected Education Commissioner Betty Castor of Tampa. She served from 1986 to 1994.
If you sit as the Commissioner of Agriculture today, guess what? You're still elected statewide. Now tell me if education isn't just as important in this state as agriculture. So I would argue strongly that when we thought we were going to take politics out of education, what we did was to lose the advocacy and the understanding and the commitment to support education.
If you have the whole cabinet sitting as the Board of Education, then you have a direct link that you can use your vote as a protest or as approval.
Absolutely. And the other thing is it's very public. When the governor and the cabinet meet, people know about it. Anyone can attend those meetings and anyone can get on the agenda. Whereas the Board of Education, appointed by the governor, is almost a secret group. People don't know who they are. They don't take advice from local school boards. And I think the key problem today is that there are no advocates for education for education policy statewide. So you have parents that want to have input, certainly teachers that want to have input, but our local boards of education, our superintendents, our chambers of commerce, everybody wants to have input. And today, I think that is blocked by the fact that there is just one key operative, and the governor appoints a board of education and they answer to the governor. And the Secretary of Education answers to the governor.
And then when you end up with a Board of Education statewide that's all appointees, there's politics in appointments.
Of course there's politics in appointments, and it has a lot to do with whether you supported the top person, in this case the governor. Did you contribute to his campaigns? That should not be the litmus test. Why aren't there teachers on the Board of Education? Why aren't there people who have been the strongest advocates? Where's that parent that came out of the PTA? I think that the state has not been served, and I don't think it's simply a partisan thing. But I'm delighted that this idea now is gaining support, even if there are not the votes in the legislature to put it on the ballot. This is going to stimulate the kind of conversation that we need about how we can change public policy.
Previously, a Democrat has tried to pass this legislation, and even some Republicans have. Do you think they might be successful this year?
I'm not sure. I have been pleasantly surprised that there is so much discussion all of a sudden. And I think it's because we have reached a crescendo, if you will, based around this testing issue. And when the Congress can reject No Child Left Behind in a bipartisan, overwhelming vote, I think it's possible to build that support at the state level.
Thank you for your time.
Yeah, thank you.
The rising cost of health care is putting a strain on the state budget. Florida Matters' Sammy Mack reports.
This September, Florida's top economist, Amy Baker, stood in front of the state's Joint Legislative Budget Commission in Tallahassee and presented an economic forecast for the next few years. The general revenue is projected to go up, and so is the cost of health care.
Medicaid is by far and away our largest driver in this year's long-range financial outlook.
According to Baker, Florida's contribution to Medicaid will take up more than a third of the state budget. There are a lot of reasons for this, but she told legislators the big one is the cost of special new drugs for hard-to-treat illnesses.
Hepatitis C, cystic fibrosis, other things. And they're extremely costly medications, and so those pharmaceutical costs are a very significant player.
According to the industry group America's Health Insurance Plans, these special medications account for 1% of all prescriptions and about a third of all drug spending. David Poole is director of legislative affairs for the AIDS Healthcare Foundation, which runs a Medicaid healthcare plan. He points out some of these specialty drugs are so new, nobody knows how to budget for them.
It's incredibly challenging to try to predict or pull that crystal ball up and discern what it is we need to budget for or how we need to negotiate rates.
Take the example of Sovaldi. It's one of the new drugs that can cure hepatitis C. And in 2014, within months of FDA approval, Florida had spent more than $11 million on Sovaldi to treat a few hundred Medicaid patients. That's a lot less than liver transplants would cost for all those people. And the state has since developed a threshold for how sick patients must be before they can get the drug. But it still upended prescription budgets for Florida's Medicaid plans.
And this is happening more and more often where new drugs are brought to market and they are standard of care. And we at AHF and other health plans want to do right by our patients or our beneficiaries. We often don't have any idea what the price point will be.
Joel Menges is CEO of the Menges Group, which does a lot of Medicaid and Medicare consulting. He says Florida Medicaid has one of the highest average costs per prescription in the country.
The policies around how Medicaid prescription drugs are handled by Florida needs a lot of therapy. Florida should not be bottom 10 in the nation.
Part of the issue, he says, is that the state limits how Medicaid plans can control their prescription guidelines. Many of the insurance companies offering Medicaid plans in Florida have lost money since the state moved to a managed care model. The Florida Association of Health Plans commissioned an analysis of prescription spending, and in a letter to the state, they outlined how costs went up by more than 22% when they had to start using the state's prescription drug guidelines. According to Bianca DiGiulio, who does healthcare policy opinion research with the Kaiser Family Foundation, the public wants change, too.
The cost of prescription drugs was the top thing that the public really wants policymakers to be focusing on.
DiGiulio says even when consumers feel like they can afford their own medications, they think drug costs are just too high. And as of right now, it's a bipartisan issue. Democrats and Republicans ranked it as the number one priority in health care. For Health News Florida, I'm Sammy Mack in Miami.
The state of Florida employs around 150,000 people. As Florida Matters producer Lottie Watts explains, they could be impacted by some measures being introduced this session.
In a huge ballroom at the Student Center at the University of South Florida this fall, dozens of tables filled the room with reps from insurance companies to gyms to the campus bookstore.
You need one of these? There you go. Yeah, this is the map.
They offered up grab bags, candy, and other swag.
It is fun to come to see all the vendors and have the employee benefits.
Shabnam Mira has worked for the University of South Florida for almost 2 decades.
I work as an assistant director in planning and analysis, and I look at a lot of student data and what makes a student successful at USF.
She's taking a break from her desk to go to the benefits fair. Fairs like this are an annual ritual for state workers across Florida.
Sometimes there are massage people here or a spa person here, so that's what I was here for.
Mira is one of thousands of Floridians employed by the state doing a variety of jobs. It's too much to list here, but among the jobs are corrections officers, social workers, and teachers. Mira says she's seen the state universities grow and change, but one thing that hasn't changed in recent years is how much she pays for a health plan for her family. She says the plan offered through her husband's job is much more expensive than the insurance she has as a state employee.
I have a husband who works commercially, and he's covered on my plan for this reason.
Many workers see the benefit as a trade-off for salaries that are lower than in the private sector. Since 2005, most state workers in Florida have paid $50 a month for individual coverage or $180 a month for their family. These monthly premiums are the same whether they enroll in a health maintenance organization, NHMO, or a preferred provider organization called a PPO. For more than a decade, lawmakers have tried and failed to make changes to the state employee group insurance. It's expected to come up again this session.
Something that gives you more should cost a little more.
Republican State Representative Jason Broder of Sanford chairs a health committee in the House. During the 2015 session, he proposed a bill lowering the monthly premiums for the PPO and increasing them for the HMO.
The upward adjustment reflects the fact that these are offered as richer benefits. That is the actual value of what we are giving or providing as part of the plan.
The proposal from Broder failed during last session, so it was more or less business as usual at last fall's benefits fair, where Lydia Hudson was staffing the AVMET table. That's the HMO plan available to state workers in more than half of Florida's counties, including those in Tampa Bay, South Florida, and Central Florida.
Biggest question is, how much is this going to cost me? Is my doctor on your list of doctors?
The answer, at least for monthly premiums, was the same as it's been since 2005. USF employee Shabnam Mira, her hands full with grab bags from the benefits fair, says she's staying with her AvMed plan through the state.
I'm fine. No changes, so I'm fine.
That could be different next year if lawmakers approve changes to the health insurance that covers more than 300,000 state workers and their families. Again, most state workers get health insurance for $50 a month for themselves or $180 for a family. But quite a few get a much better deal, including lawmakers in the Florida House, the governor, and certain managers. They pay $8.34 for individual coverage or $30 a month for family coverage. In his budget proposal for 2016, Governor Rick Scott says he wants to see those workers pay the same monthly health insurance premiums as the rest of Florida state employees. State lawmakers, though, they get the final say. For Florida Matters, I'm Lottie Watts.
Coming up,
you want to be careful when you get into proposing a bill to regulate something. Very often, you then stifle any further development.
I'm Kirsten Cooper. This is Florida Matters. I'm Carson Cooper. This is Florida Matters. We're previewing the upcoming Florida legislative session. Florida Matters' Robin Sussingham recently caught up with State Senator John Legge. The Republican represents parts of Pasco and Hillsborough counties and chairs the Senate Education Committee.
The biggest education issues that I see are going to be dealing with class size, looking at how school districts are complying with class size. The House has made a priority looking at the best and brightest, which is a recruitment and a merit reward for teachers, around $10,000 for certain teachers.
Now, that's pretty controversial. Yeah. If you took an SAT 30 years ago, you're going to get $10,000 if you did well.
Yeah. So last year in the budget negotiation process, the House put in a proposal that would about $44 million, where the target was to recruit and reward teachers who had 80th percentile or higher on their SAT scores to recruit them into teaching. The Senate did not have a chance to review that proposal. This year, I've actually filed the bill specifically for the purpose so that the Senate would get a chance to debate the issue. I have some significant reservations with the methodology of implementation of the legislation. And there may be a better way of recruiting our best and brightest and putting them into the schools than simply looking at a test score from 30 years ago. But I think under its present form, the best and brightest is going to have a challenging time in the legislature, especially in the Senate. There's also always school choice is always a big issue, and high school athletics will kind of dominate, I think, the issues this year. Unlike last year's, I don't think testing will dominate the legislature, but I'm confident that there will be some review of testing and technology, but I don't think it will dominate the legislature like the last few years.
Parents in several school districts around the state have been organizing mainly online to bring back recess to the kids' schools. And up until now, the state hasn't had any mandates about recess. Do you think we'll see anything on that this upcoming session?
There's a reluctance to mandate more recess because that means you will be taking up time from another core class. And there'll be a constituency out there that will say we can't cut down math, reading, art, music. And rightfully so. You have to give up something or you have to add more hours to the day, and those hours will cost money.
So lawmakers have been trying for several years to overhaul the Florida High School Athletic Association. What do you see happening there?
There really are two major proposals that are going forward. One of them is by Senator Don Gates, which basically says that we are just going to allow students to move between schools for any reason, including high school athletics.
This is doing away with zoning?
Doing away with zoning at school districts. And that will have some major impacts on athletics. The second proposal out there is to allow a competitor of FHSAA, which pretty much has a monopoly right now in high school athletics. I would look for those issues to emerge and be hotly debated.
Going back and talking about the class sizes, that was a big deal when Florida ruled that there were maximum class sizes.
We've tried for years to try to build in some common sense flexibility, but still obey the spirit of the law. It looks as though that school districts have taken advantage of some loopholes. We're looking at some of the school districts now to see, are they violating that good faith effort and taking advantage too much of the flexibilities that the legislature has granted them?
Charter schools are schools that receive public education dollars, but they aren't controlled by local school districts. The hope is they'll bring innovative ways of teaching to those districts. But there have been problems with them.
What the legislature is looking at specifically from the House this year is how do we still allow charter schools to exist, because there's a huge parental demand for them. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, how do we ensure that quality operators are the ones that are opening? And how do we recognize and have warnings that when they're not doing well, that we go in there and we either shut them down or we allow another person to take them over if, for one reason or another, they're not a quality management company.
In 2014, voters approved Amendment 1, which sets aside money for land buying and preservation. As Florida Matters' Steve Newborn reports, lawmakers are still trying to figure out where that money should go.
Early in 2015, three adventurers walked, hiked, and kayaked 1,000 miles from the headwaters of the Everglades across the Panhandle to the Alabama state line. Their goal, to bring attention to the need to protect Florida's remaining natural lands before they're paved over. Tampa photographer Carlton Ward Jr. spoke about the Florida Wildlife Corridor Expedition's mission while paddling a protected stretch of river near Pensacola.
While we're out here, state lawmakers are in session, and I can't help but think that there's still not enough appreciation and emphasis on protecting these remaining wild places, because in the next few years, if we don't make some moves, some of these connections are gone.
Lawmakers are soon back in session, but have they really made any moves to protect these wild areas? Republican David Simmons is a state senator from Altamont Springs.
We don't need to just go out and buy a bunch of land because it happens to be money available to do that. What we want to know is 20 years from now, we can look and we can tell our children, our grandchildren, that we solved the problem for the preservation and the restoration of our resources.
What solving the problem actually means depends on who you talk to. Three-quarters of the state's voters approved Amendment 1 in 2014 that mandated one-third of taxes collected on real estate transactions, known as dock stamps, go to the State Land Acquisition Trust Fund. It would be used to acquire, restore, improve, and manage conservation lands. That could mean as much as $300 million would be available in the upcoming fiscal year. Governor Scott has requested a budget that would include only $63 million for the land acquisition program Florida Forever, but he also wants $50 million to help maintain the state's natural springs and another $10 million to give matching grants to local communities for land buying. Last year, Simmons said lawmakers are meeting the requirements of Amendment 1.
I can tell you that the senators with whom I have spoken believe very strongly that we're going to comply with not only the letter but the spirit of this constitutional amendment, and there will need to be a nexus between the preservation and improvement of our environment, particularly our water resources.
In December, State Representative Gail Harrell of Stewart and incoming Senate President Joe Negron filed bills to funnel $200 million annually from Amendment 1 to restore the Florida Everglades and nearby waterways in central and southern Florida. That's 25% of the money expected to flow from Amendment 1. But what about the other 75% for everything north of the Everglades? Environmentalists say the pot of money that voters wanted used to preserve land is being eyed for everything from water projects to beach renourishment.
We need to have a blueprint, really, for the entire state.
Mallory Likes-Dimmitt organized the Florida Wildlife Corridor Expedition.
It's not just the Everglades, which are critically important, the largest restoration project in the world, but also it's important in the Suwannee River watershed. It's important in Northwest Florida. It's important in Northeast Florida. And we can show projects that are on the Florida Forever list that are waiting for funding and approvals in every part of the state.
She says there are other options besides outright purchase of land. Florida Forever funds can also buy what are called conservation easements.
There's a large number of willing landowners who are looking for this kind of funding to stay as a landowner. They will continue the upkeep, the maintenance of the land, but you're guaranteeing that for the future, that doesn't become more intensive development.
Several environmental groups last year sued the state, saying lawmakers used Amendment 1 money for salaries and operating expenses. A Tallahassee judge in December rejected part of the lawsuit, but he may have the final say on what lawmakers can and cannot do with the money. For Florida Matters, I'm Steve Newborn.
Lawmakers are expected once again to take up the issue of telemedicine. Florida Matters' Daylena Miller explains.
With just a few clicks of the mouse, Orlando mom Alyssa Grimes visits with a pediatrician from the comfort of her living room. She logs into a Skype-like application on her laptop where she virtually meets her child's doctor based across town at Nemours Children's Hospital.
Hi, I'm Dr. Vias with Nemours.
This is Zach, and this is Zachary's mom. My name is Alyssa.
What's going on today?
Well, Zachary woke up this morning not feeling so well.
After the virtual visit, Grimes says 5-year-old Zach was unfazed by the technology. He's grown up with it.
Nowadays, that's how a lot of children connect with friends and family, is through like a FaceTime. So it was very, very similar to speaking with his grandma or grandpa over FaceTime or Skype.
This telehealth service isn't covered by insurance. Patients must pay $49 per visit. And that's where telehealth gets tricky. There's no state law forbidding, restricting, or regulating telehealth. So the biggest obstacle for patients and doctors is, who pays? Nancy Wright is a pediatric endocrinologist in Tallahassee. 35% of her patients are in Georgia, where she's also licensed.
I am doing telemedicine out of my office in Tallahassee into Valdosta, a clinic there, a children's medical services clinic.
Wright says her field is so specialized that many patients drive up to 100 miles to see her in person. The virtual space is a good option, but she says she needs to get paid in Florida like she does in Georgia.
It is financially sound for the office to do this. We are paid for these visits by the children's insurance companies. In Georgia, there's only one or two insurance companies that would refuse telemedicine. Everybody else is very welcoming about this.
Christian Caballero is president of the Telehealth Association of Florida. He says the group has proposed several ideas requiring insurance to cover a visit via telehealth. The group's first proposal was turned down. It required insurance companies to cover a visit via telehealth if it was covered face-to-face.
Apparently, the insurance companies objected to it vehemently. They didn't want to be forced to provide this coverage.
A second proposal offering insurance companies corporate tax credits also failed to get support.
That also has received some opposition from the insurance companies, and so they don't want to go with that either.
Carrie Pigman is an emergency physician in Highlands and Hardy counties and a representative in the Florida House. He says he won't accept a plan that regulates telehealth in any way.
You want to be careful when you get into proposing a bill to regulate something. Very often you then stifle any further development.
He says it may be better for the state to do nothing.
If we do nothing, I think the business will continue to proliferate and unique products will be available.
Alyssa Grimes, the mother in Orlando, says while she doesn't mind paying cash for virtual visits, it'd be nice if there were more telehealth options covered by insurance. But Pigman says he's doubtful lawmakers will have much to offer in terms of answers this coming session. For Health News Florida, I'm Daylena Miller.
Insured patients could be getting some protection from surprise health care bills. As Florida Matters' Carol Gentry reports, balanced billing can happen when patients get care from doctors, hospitals, and other health care providers that aren't part of their insurance network.
David Rogers of Tampa thought it was just a paperwork mix-up when his wife Melanie got a notice that their insurance would not pay a doctor bill of $27,000 for emergency care.
My reaction was kind of shock and disbelief, and my wife has also been in shock ever since.
But it isn't a mix-up. It's an increasingly common practice that can leave insured patients in the same boat as the uninsured. Some call it surprise billing, but the official term used in Tallahassee is balance billing, in that patients are being charged the balance of what insurance doesn't cover. Sharon James, Florida's insurance consumer advocate, says unexpected bills are sending patients to collection agencies and even bankruptcy.
There are consumers that are actually foregoing medical treatment because they're unclear and unsure as to what the financial consequence of that treatment may be.
Florida law bars this kind of billing for HMO patients, but it doesn't protect those enrolled in PPOs, a similar kind of health plan that covers millions of Floridians. James recently released a proposal for lawmakers to consider in this year's legislative session.
The impact on Florida consumers is substantial, which is why we're definitely recommending a fix to this problem.
James told a House subcommittee that hospitals, doctors, and insurance companies know balance billing is a problem.
All of these stakeholders agreed that something needed to happen, that we needed to fix this issue for consumers. And of course, you all are aware, the big question is, how do you do that?
Take the example of emergency rooms. The hospital may be in a patient's PPO network, but the ER doctor may not be. Dr. Daniel Brennan of Orlando is on the board of the Florida College of Emergency Physicians. He says ER doctors turn to balance billing when plans don't pay enough.
If we receive adequate payment from the insurance company, then it's a moot point for the patients. They don't get a balance bill.
But the Florida Association of Health Plans says some ER doctors refuse to contract so that they can charge the patient many times more than the standard rates from private plans or Medicare. President and CEO Audrey Brown cites a report from a national insurers group.
The study shows that in Florida, average charges for emergency department visits are between 500% and 750% of Medicare.
Consumer advocate James says that after listening to all the players and studying other states, she wants patients taken out of the middle. She says the state should set up a process to make the PPOs and out-of-network billers resolve their own disputes. If they can't reach agreement, she says, the next step would be arbitration. James's proposal doesn't address surprise bills for non-emergency treatments, but she says it covers most cases.
Clearly, the greatest consumer impact is in the emergency context.
Since she made the proposal, lobbying against balance billing reform has dwindled. Representative Evan Jenny, a Broward County Democrat, says changes in the air.
After you've been here for a little while, you can see when the stars start to align and you can tell something is going to happen.
Back in Tampa, the Rogers family still faces the big doctor bill from last year. But if there's an emergency this year, they'll be protected.
Because it doesn't make any sense to be paying for an insurance that doesn't cover you.
At open enrollment, David Rogers says he switched to an HMO. For Health News Florida, I'm Carol Gentry in St. Petersburg.
And that's it for today's show. You can see more details about the upcoming legislative session at WUSFnews.org. Just click on the Florida Matters link. Florida Matters is produced by Lottie Watts. Our engineer is Craig George, and our program is a production of WUSF Public Media. I'm Carson Cooper. Thanks for listening.